So today we're going to be finishing a three-part series that Charlie began that is going over the four parables in Matthew 24 and 25. And when we started the series, he started by giving us the background to why Jesus tells these stories. So at the very beginning of Matthew 24, just a couple of verses let us know what the context is that these stories are told in. It says, Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So basically what's happening here is that the disciples are with Jesus in Jerusalem. They point out to him the beauty of the temple. And he, in turn, responds by telling them that there is going to come a day when the temple is no longer left standing, which for a Jewish person would have been kind of crushing news. But they are linking this then to the establishment of his kingdom, which he's talked about being something that would in some ways replace the current kingdom of Israel. And so they ask him, how will we know when these things are going to happen? And he tells them over and over again, nobody knows when that these things are going to take place, but there will be signs. And he begins to speak sometimes with subtlety, sometimes not so subtly, about really two separate events that in their minds are the same. The first is the sacking of Jerusalem in 70 AD. He begins to talk about what the environment will be like at that time, what the world will look like, and what the experience will be for those who are in Jerusalem. It's going to be a terrifying time, and this is something that happened in 70 AD. Rome came in, destroyed Jerusalem, and tore down the temple. So this thing that Jesus said about the temple not being left standing is something that happens 40 years from now. And so the people that Jesus is talking to will experience that. But he also talks about the signs of his coming kingdom or the establishment of the end of the age, which to the disciples is still something that's going to be happening momentarily because they don't understand yet that the crucifixion is a necessary part of his establishment of the kingdom. And so we look back at his description of those events, and it's what we call the second coming, when Jesus is eventually going to return, fully establish his kingdom, and set everything right. So in the midst of this, Jesus tells four stories, explaining to them, this is how you live in the waiting. So the first parable is very short. It's basically a description of two different servants. In both cases, the master leaves the head servant in charge. He goes away and says, I don't know when I'm going to return. One servant is faithful, continues to do the thing the master has put him in charge of doing. Master comes back in the middle of the night. It's a surprise, but he finds the servant faithful and rewards him. The other servant, seeing that his master is staying away for a long time, is unfaithful, begins to act violently, begins to drink a lot, and basically not only isn't responsible for the things he was supposed to be responsible for, but ends up tearing down the master's household. The master comes back and he's punished as an unfaithful servant. The heart of this story is basically in the waiting, live every day as though that could be the day I return. Because you don't know when it's going to happen. You want to be found faithful. The second parable is the one that Charlie spent more time with. It's the parable of the 10 virgins. Charlie talked a lot about the wedding ceremony for Jewish people, how basically the ceremony would start once a groom had finished building a house where he and his wife would live. There would be a parade all through the city, inviting everybody in town to the celebration. In this story, there are 10 women who are all waiting for the parade to happen so that they can come to the festival. They have to have lamps to get around outside. Five of them have enough oil because it takes longer than they think. Five of them don't. The ones who are prepared are allowed into the celebration. The ones who are not prepared are not allowed into the celebration. Where Charlie took this parable was the idea of Christianity being a long haul kind of commitment. The disciples were expecting Jesus to establish his kingdom at any point. We're 2,000 years past that point, and it still hasn't happened. So there's some waiting that's happening for some of us. And for those of us who have been doing this for 5, 10, 40 years, Christianity can definitely start to feel like a long-haul commitment. And Charlie talked about this process that we go through where we start naive. We just kind of accept everything by faith, whatever we've been taught or assumed. And eventually we come to a place where we begin to deconstruct some of those things. And we enter a time of skepticism where we pull apart everything that we've assumed, everything we've been taught, and we realize that there are some flaws. But the best thing for us to do is to then move past that to a place of mature faith, where we can look at those things we've deconstructed and we can find the truth in them, even though they might not be exactly what we initially thought they were. The example that he used was the tortoise and the hare, that as a child, you read that story and you think a literal rabbit and a literal turtle decided on a throwdown, picked a place, did the race, whoever wins, okay. But eventually we come to a place of deconstructing that story and realize rabbits and turtles don't so much talk, and generally I don't see them in foot races, so this probably isn't a true story. But maturity brings us to a place where we say, okay, this isn't a literal story. This isn't something that actually happened, but I have found it to be true that slow and steady does in fact win the race. And so there is truth to this story, even though it's not quite what I originally thought. And I think as Christians, this can happen for us in our approach to the Bible, in our approach to the historical Jesus, in our approach to church, certain theological issues, even in our own personal definition of what it means to be a Christian. And so this process, as we go through the long haul, is about committing to not stopping at the deconstruction phase of skepticism, but pushing through that to a place of mature faith and how we approach all the aspects of what it means to be a Christian. And then last week, Dustin took the parable of the talents, which is the next in the series. A master gives three different servants different amounts of money, goes away, comes back, and rewards or punishes them based on what they did with those things. And he invited people to come up and share with us ways that they're using their skills, their passions, their abilities to advance the kingdom of God now, even while we're waiting for Jesus to come and fully establish it. So we heard from people who are doing things within Imago's walls and all throughout the city and even beyond to try to advance the kingdom in the ways that Jesus said his kingdom should look. Everybody with us so far? Everybody remember? Okay. So this week we're going to do the final parable in the series and continue to answer the question, how do we live in the waiting? So we just heard it, and it is a little repetitive, but I'm going to read it again. If you want to turn to Matthew 25, page 807, we're going to start in verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people from one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you? The king will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did for the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger or needing clothes, or sick or in prison, and did not help you? He will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. So what is the point of this parable? If it has one meaning, what is the meaning of this parable? Have you heard it taught? What do you think when you read it? Okay, so being selfless. So part of being a child of heaven is we give. If we see a need, we give, and that's a part of what it means. Okay, so do for others what you would want done for you if you're in that situation. Good. Okay, so two uncomfortable things. One, there's a lot of eternal significance placed on these actions. And two, there is a lack of reference to what we believe, if this is about salvation, but the eternal consequence of living this way. So Joe says that this actually gives us a really accessible and simple way to find God and communicate with God, because he equates himself with those in need, and we can find people in need very easily and interact with God in that way. So the previous parables were more about an attitude of patience, whereas this one is more about continuous action. So Jesus is identifying both with us as we seek to advance his kingdom, like Dustin talked about last week, but he also identifies himself with those who receive the things that we do. So he's identifying with both ends of that process. It's good. Yeah, so both the group of sheep and the group of goats are surprised when Jesus tells them that he has identified with those that they did or did not reach out to. So there's kind of a revealing. We don't really know, maybe in the moment, but Jesus is receiving, whether it's our action or inaction or neglect. Yeah, so this does tie into other places in Scripture where it says that you will know whether or not somebody really is a follower of Jesus by how they live. So this isn't the only place where we see that sort of thing being described by what we do rather than what we believe. So I'm going to let you know, just so nobody's waiting or wondering, what I'm not going to talk about today. All of the things I'm about to mention have lots of different theological interpretations, and I'm happy to talk to anybody about any of these things one-on-one, but they're not going to be covered today, so you don't have to wait for me to bring them up. I'm not going to talk about heaven, hell, or eternal damnation. I'm not going to talk about salvation by deeds, faith versus works, or the role our actions play in our salvation. I'm not going to talk about social justice issues like, prisons, open borders, the poor, things like that. And I'm not going to talk about judgment. Who are the sheep? Who are the goats? Is this a judgment of salvation or a different judgment? Of the seven judgments that we see described in Scripture, is this one of those or something separate? None of it. I'm not talking about any of it. So if you want to talk about those things later, I'm happy to do so. The reason I'm not going to talk about it is because I feel like the best way for us to understand these parables is to understand them all answering the same question. So I want to start by talking about Jesus' audience, which is the disciples, which we saw at the beginning when it says that they came to him privately. Jesus is about to be crucified, and he is preparing these really ultimately 11 men to take his message and establish a church. And so the words that he speaks near the end of every gospel are the words that he's giving them to equip them for the work he's about to leave to them. For the first several decades of the church, the people that they are going to be ministering to, for the most part, are oppressed, politically oppressed, poverty-stricken, often ill, agricultural Jews who are always facing imprisonment for things like not paying exorbitant taxes that they genuinely can't afford, not being willing to worship false gods, and not being willing to denounce Jesus in the face of the Jewish leaders. So there are very specific needs that are going to be facing the people that they are ministering to. These people will have a lack of food. They will have a lack of access to clean water. They will have poor sanitation. They will face unfair imprisonment, and they will often be displaced. If we want to think about places in our world where people face these same needs, it is not hard to do. We can think of the Middle East. We can think of Eastern Europe, a lot of places in Asia, South America, Africa. However, while we have some of these things in the West, these are not, for the most part, for people in this room, the primary needs that we face. I hope that everybody can say that that's fair. Great things have come from taking this list literally. Prison ministries, outreach to immigrants and foreign students, our own efforts at Imago, and relieving the suffering of the poor. But every parable is by nature a limited analogy. They're usually answering one question. And again, all of these parables are answering the question, how do we live in the waiting while we're waiting for Jesus to return? It's easy to look at this passage and equate living with readiness with this specific exact list of deeds. But I want to ask another question, and this one might hit a little closer to home. I'm going to ask you to be brave and answer it for me so that I'm not sitting up here awkwardly. What are the needs that face the people that you know in this room, your families, your friends, your coworkers, your neighbors? If you had to write a list like Jesus wrote this list, what are the biggest needs facing the people that you know? Friendship? Isolation. Understanding. Trust. Acceptance. Good. We're on the same page. I'm going to put some statistics up, and I want to be clear both before and after I do this, that I am not in any way saying that the things I'm about to put up can be remedied by us being good friends to each other. But I do believe that what I'm about to show you is illustrative for the kinds of things that we are facing in the U.S. as just everyday people currently. So these are all, and I'm not a huge fan of stats, but I felt like it was helpful. So if you're like me and you don't like statistics, just tune out for a minute. You can glance up at the screen when it's all done. These are statistics as of 2007, which were the most current that I could find. These are reported cases, so it doesn't cover any unreported issues, obviously, as of 2007 in the United States. Of our entire population, those struggling with anxiety or panic disorders made up over 20% of the U.S. Population. Those suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress, a lot of times soldiers or people who have suffered abuse, 3.5%, which makes up 7.7 million people. People struggling with attention deficit issues, ADD or ADHD, 4.1%. Eating disorders, including anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating, 24 million people. Of all mental illness categories, this is the one with the highest mortality rate of 4%. Mood disorders, this would be depression, dysthymia, which is like a low-grade depression, or bipolar disorder. 9.5% of the population are struggling with these. 6.7% alone are facing depression. Personality disorders, which would be things like antisocial disorder, borderline disorder, and avoidant disorder, all of which are largely also misunderstood by the general population. 9.1% of the population. In 2011, reported cases of substance abuse or dependence by those over the age of 12, 20.6 million people. The rate of obesity was at 3.9. Households in debt in 2011 were 69%. The average amount of unsecured debt, meaning there's no collateral, we're not talking houses, cars, anything like that, average amount was $7,000. There is a suicide once every 15 minutes in the United States. The overwhelming majority are white males between the ages of 45 and 59 years old. Okay, so take a deep breath, super heavy. If you tuned out, go ahead and glance at the screen real quick. I'm gonna move on. Again, let me say, I am not stating that any of these issues are things that can be eradicated through a little bit of warm fuzzy. They are things that need to be addressed with professionals, with help, with medication, things like that. So please do not misunderstand. A lot of times these are grossly misunderstood and mistreated in the Christian world. So I don't want to in any way contribute to those misunderstandings. However, I do believe that these statistics are symptomatic of a deeper systemic issue facing the majority of people in the West. I believe, like you seem to, that our needs are wrapped up in words like loneliness, isolation, meaninglessness, hopelessness, and despair. We feel empty, afraid, or worthless most of the time because we don't do enough. We aren't blank enough. We are too blank. We aren't good enough at. We haven't yet achieved. Whatever the thing is, we identify ourselves most with what we lack, which leads to feelings like our lives are meaningless and we are worthless. My personal understanding of what we have to offer each other has changed drastically over the last couple of years. It started with the passing of a friend of mine. He was a really well-known painter in the area and actually even outside of this area. He was very talented, very attractive, very charismatic, super cool. You always knew he was in a room, not because he made himself known, but because you just couldn't help it. There was this aura of energy around him everywhere. He was the kind of person that you should have felt intimidated by, but nobody ever really did. He married my childhood best friend, and so I got to know him very well for the 7 years that they were together. And he passed away rather suddenly 2 years ago. So I spent a week helping with memorials and funerals and things like that, and spent a lot of time listening to people's stories of Vin. And over and over and over again, people echoed the same experience I had had with him, whether they had met him once at One World or were lifelong friends of his since he got here when he was 17. People consistently said, I just felt so seen and heard when I was with him. I just felt like I was significant when I was with him. We all knew that he was able to capture and create beauty on a canvas. But his greater talent turned out to be drawing beauty out of people that was already there, that they weren't even keyed into themselves. This was a person who had everything to offer. And when you were with him, what he was focused on was what you had to offer, drawing it out, making you aware of it, and validating it. And this one little thing literally impacted hundreds of people. And so over the course of that week, I was trying to analyze what is this thing that made him so impactful to so many people. There were 8 people who spoke at the funeral. There were like 500 people between the visitation and funeral that day. I've never seen somebody in this area have such a big impact, and I really needed to figure out what it was. And at the end of the day, all I could come up with was that he was incredibly present wherever he was. And so over the course of that same week, I had had Mumford & Sons CD in my car almost continuously for like a year, and it's just background noise. But I'm sitting at a stoplight, I'm thinking about these things, and all of a sudden a line pops out that I had never noticed before. And it was half a phrase, I will love with urgency, but not with haste. And this phrase somehow just embedded itself in me in that moment. And I've spent the last couple years just trying to figure out what does it mean to love urgently, but not with haste. Because I think that's what Vin was doing. And so one of the things I've realized is that I often love with haste, and I think most of us do. And I think what that means is that we are driven to love out of our own need. And so we scramble and run from surface encounter to surface encounter, whether it's with your spouse or your kid or your coworker or your friend. It's very rare that we actually are present and focused on the person that we're communicating with. Loving with urgency acknowledges that our moments are limited, and as cheesy as it sounds, this moment is the only one that we have. And so I started experimenting. There was a person who had reached out to me a couple of times. He's somebody that everybody in Peoria knows. He's super friendly. Everybody loves him. Huge, high respect from everybody who's met him. I would run into him occasionally out, and he would be inordinately excited to see me. I did not understand it, but I knew that there was something more. Like, I knew that we needed to connect again, like that we weren't done. But I have a big fear of rejection. I was really insecure. I didn't want to be misinterpreted by reaching out. I didn't want to be shot down or dismissed. And so I had hesitated for months. So when these things were happening, I decided to just try it, ask him if he wanted to get coffee. He jumped at it. We only had a couple of coffee dates before he moved out of the state. But over the course of the time that I spent with him, he was, again, always so focused. I was the only person in the room. He was full of excitement, good questions, genuine interest in the things that we were talking about, sharing himself as well. He left a permanent impression, because I realized that it didn't matter that we didn't become forever friends, because those individual moments that we had mattered, and they seemed to have mattered to both of us. And so a couple months later, I met somebody else who is in and out of my life through a common area that we share. He was new to the city, didn't really have any connections. Again, I was super afraid of rejection, super insecure, really worried about being misunderstood if I reached out. And I did. And it was awkward, and it was stumbly this time. And I often loved with haste, looking for validation or some sort of acknowledgement. But through all of it, there was just kind of this patient movement forward, and a friendship has evolved out of that. And so once again, I felt like people want to be connected with. I realized that as afraid as I am of being rejected, it's better than leaving somebody floating in a city with no connections when I could have been the one to reach out to them. I think there are 2 reasons that we don't pay attention and that we don't love this way, that we aren't present with each other. The first is the fear of rejection, of being dismissed, of seeming foolish, of not being worthy, or that too much will be demanded of us. Like I'll reach out to this person and all of a sudden there won't be best friends and I don't have time for another best friend in my life. And so we hesitate because we don't believe that that one moment will be enough. I think our culture teaches us to handle issues like this, these really heavy ones, on our own or in the privacy of a counselor's office, but not to burden each other with them, especially men, not to stereotype. I still think that you're being taught that you're not allowed to open up about some of these things. And we are so worried about image management that the idea of rejection terrifies us. So we would rather not reach out to somebody because we can't handle the idea of being rejected. And talking to a friend about this once, he had said that he had gone through a process of changing how he thinks about these things to where he realized that if he extends himself in love to somebody, in friendship to somebody, and that's rejected, it doesn't mean that he was offering himself. And so it doesn't have to be a personal rejection. It can just be a simple matter that I extended myself in love and this person is not in a place where they need or want that friendship right now. And so I can take it back and it's okay. There's not a personal rejection there. I've experienced this with other people reaching out to me. Somebody who assumed that I was too busy to be able to connect, reached out anyway, extended an invitation, expecting rejection. But I was able to respond to that, and she's become a really important part of my life. I started paying attention to little notes that people would send, or texts, or Facebook messages, moments with people I only ever see at church in between the services, but realizing that if I'm present in those moments, they actually do still matter. And it's not great that I'm not being able to connect with them outside of the service, but it's also not bad that we are connecting in those moments. I think the other reason that we don't reach out to each other this way is that most of us probably need to acknowledge that we might be at a place in our lives where we're the ones who need the cup of cold water. We're the ones struggling to find meaning or worth or value. We're the ones driven to distraction, to addiction, to spending, to food, to entertainment or work or sex, to avoid real connection or to try to avoid the emptiness that we feel. We are the ones who are so busy, so worn down, trying to fill our lives with any kind of meaning or fill our voids with any kind of significance that we really do have nothing left to give. We are weary and we're stressed and we're drained. Early on in the church, I was taught that issues like self-esteem were worldly, that they were of the flesh, that they were ego, and that as Christians, we were just supposed to sacrifice ourselves, lay down our lives for each other, and move on, and Jesus would be the one to fill us. And okay, so there's some truth to that, but I also at some point had to call bull, because I looked around me and I realized that almost everybody I knew was living out of one deeply held truth, that they were worthless and broken with nothing to offer if stripped down to their basic humanity. But the reality is that Jesus was fully human, and he only ever offered himself, and he calls us to live like he lived. And so our humanity can't be that bad. Our core identity has to be that we belong to God, that we are made in his image, that we are loved exactly as we are, and that we're being redeemed because we are flawed, but ultimately we are made of the stuff of heaven. At Imago, we talk about it being that the story begins in Genesis 1 when things are good, not Genesis 3 when things get broken. I think that what we need in order to move forward in these things is courage. I think we need to be able to admit our own needs. I think we need to figure out how to be present to the people around us. We need to face our fears and our insecurities and not be limited by them. We need to stop escaping feelings of inadequacy, despair, and meaningless, and address them with the love and support that's available to us. And if we don't have that love and support, then we need to ask God to show us where we can find it. We need to grow in the knowledge that we are deeply loved and center our identities in that reality alone. And so what does it mean to live in the waiting? With Charlie, we talked about the fact that that we're in it for the long haul, that we're moving past deconstruction and skepticism to a deeper faith. With Dustin, we talked about using what we have, following our passions, following the things that we're good at to see the kingdom grow here and now, even as we're waiting for Jesus to ultimately fulfill it. And I think it boils down to whether it's a list of cold water and clothes or a list of meaning and hope and significant connection, extending compassion to the person in front of you, whoever they are, wherever they are. Loving the way Jesus loved until Jesus returns. The Gospels are full of the most significant encounters any human being has ever had with God. And they were almost all individual encounters. Touching the ostracized leper before healing him. Spending an afternoon answering deep theological questions to a woman who was three times an outcast in her community. Eating breakfast with a man who was possessed by demons and terrorized a city for years. Protecting a cheating woman from a firing squad of religious leaders. Inviting himself to the home of an infamous criminal in his community. Training and living with 12 low society men for 3 years. Washing the feet of the man who would betray him to crucifixion a few hours later. And Jesus' refrain through the course of his life was to love each other. They will know you by your love. The greatest of these is love. Love as I have loved you. Jesus spent his life on earth maintaining the dignity, the worth, and the humanity of the people with whom he interacted. And we all have it within us to do the same. Make eye contact with somebody. Be present in a conversation. Hug someone for real. We have a really great example of that in Dustin. Seriously. Write a card or send a text or a Facebook message. Don't put the pressure on yourself to all of a sudden start waxing eloquent with your annoying coworker in the cubicle next to you, but just try to find something to compliment them about. Ask a question, like a real question in a conversation with somebody, an uncomfortable question even. I do it all the time. You just say, you don't have to answer this, but, and ask the question, and they almost always will. You don't have to commit to a lifelong friendship to give somebody your full presence, to give somebody your full attention in the moment. It can be a cashier or a waiter. It can be an annoying coworker or fellow student, a distant spouse, a domineering parent. We don't have to spend our humanity on somebody to recognize their beauty and their value in the moment. And I genuinely believe that if we spend our lives perfecting this one thing, actually caring for each other through compassion, by validating our worth and meaning in the story, whether it's a hospital visit or a cup of cold water or a word of hope or a thoughtful question, we will have lived well in the waiting. It's the most Christ-like example we can possibly set in the world to take care of the people in front of us. We are not responsible for their well-being, but we are responsible to reach out to them to help ensure their well-being. So we're going to end with something a little different. And for some of you, this is going to feel like crawling the walls. And for some of you, you're going to love this. But we used the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi last week in a couple of different ways. And we're going to do so again today. Basically, I'm going to put the first half of the prayer up one slide at a time. And I'm going to leave 30 seconds of silence in between each one. So for those of you who aren't familiar with meditation or silence, expect to get distracted a lot, for your mind to wander. And that's okay. Anybody who goes into the practice, it's going to happen. And we're taking really short snippets of time to be quiet. If you get distracted, just look back up at the screen. The line will be up there. And then just refocus. And you might have to do that every 5 seconds. And that's okay. There are notepads in the pews if you need to jot something down, if that helps you stay focused. For some people, it does. But the point of this is that I just feel like through all of the sermons that we've heard in this series, but especially this one, I want to make some space for the Spirit to maybe bring something to mind, either something that you need to reach out to somebody to help with because you're seeing a need in your own life, or because you recognize that there's somebody that you need to be present to in a different way. And so we're going to talk about things like hope and darkness and light. And I just want you to try to use your imagination to see if somebody comes to mind or if something for you comes to mind. So again, some of you are going to feel like you're crawling the walls. I promise it really will only be like 4 minutes. It's going to feel like an eternity, but I have a timer. I promise I'm not going to leave you here forever. I hope everybody's okay with us doing this. So I'm going to start by just reading the first line, 30 seconds. I will read through, and then I will end with prayer, and then we'll have a benediction, and the service will be over. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. God, we just want to start by thanking you for giving us this time and space every week to recalibrate toward you. God, we want to thank you that we even have a record of the life that Jesus lived and the example that he set. We thank you for the promise that the Spirit is in us to guide us into truth and to teach us how to live. We thank you that we are not left to our own devices to love each other or only left with what we have to give, but that the reality is that that as you fill us, we can give from that place. I ask that you would give us eyes to see people and to move toward each other in new ways, in forgiveness, in offering hope, in validating one another's worth. We thank you for this time and ask that you will help us be a blessing even as we receive from you the reality that we are blessed. In Jesus' name, amen.